The Family Life Cassette of the Month Club presents Dr. James Dobson, speaking on the topic, How to Save Your Marriage. And now, Dr. Dobson.
Hello, everyone. My name is James Dobson, and I appreciate this chance to spend the next few minutes with you today. It's a rainy afternoon here in Southern California, one of the very few rainy days that we get to enjoy in this dry part of the country. And that makes it a cozy time for friends to pull up a chair and share a cup of coffee and chat together for a few minutes about a very important topic. And I hope you'll approach this tape and this message in that warm frame of mind today. Now, the tape that you're about to hear was actually recorded in the fall of 1977 in a class which I taught regularly at my church. The Centurion class, as it's called, is composed of about 150 members, most of whom are between 30 and 40 years of age, and most of whom have young families. Now, I taught this class off and on for 7 years or more, but I resigned from that responsibility on January the 1st, 1978, for the reasons that you'll soon learn. I hope you'll enjoy these comments, which deal with the impact of busy lives on the relationship between husbands and wives. And to be completely honest, I consider this message to be the most important comment that I could make to today's families, because it touches all of us. Join me now as we step into my class, where the introductory comments have just concluded, and I'll be speaking on the subject, How to Save a Marriage. As we begin, I'm about to reveal something very personal about my wife Shirley and me. And I'm going to do something this morning that I don't often do. We're going to have a little what Pastor Lee calls open heart time. And I'm going to crack the door about 2 inches and let you see me and tell you something about Shirley and me. Folks, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, Shirley and I have been blessed with a beautiful relationship. And I say that with no attempt to add humor or anything else. God has really blessed us. I enjoy her company. I can truly say that if I have one evening free and I could spend it with anybody in the world that I could choose, there'd be no one that I'd rather spend that evening with than Shirley. We have a lot in common. I like to talk to her. I never get bored with her. And we've been living together for 17 years now. And in 17 years, it has become possible for us to get to a point where I can trust her and she trusts me, and it's just not necessary to have those kind of squabbles and fights and struggles and conflict that you have to go through in early years to establish what you'll take and what you won't take, and you're not going to push me that far, and if you think I'm going to take that, you're crazy. You know, that kind of early marriage kind of thing is largely over for us, and it's possible for us to just go on month after month after month without a great deal of conflict. We very seldom fight. And that's not propaganda, that's the truth. But folks, we had a dandy last weekend. We had a beauty. We had one of the most interesting conflicts of the last 5 years last weekend. And we came here to the Sunday school class, and we sat down there, and we put this phony smile on our faces, you know, like a lot of you may be doing. And it seemed like we had it all together. And everybody looked at us, I suppose, and said, my, I wish our marriage was like that. And underneath the table, we were kicking each other. And wouldn't you know, Dave spoke on marriage and love and what God intended. And we were sitting down here agreeing with everything he said. Really, everything he said, both of us at that moment agreed with, but didn't feel it very deeply. And I couldn't help but wonder, as I was listening to Dave, how many other people in this room accepted every word he said, but didn't feel it because of hurt and because of memories and because of conflict and things that had gone on. People who wish it was not as it was at that moment, wished that they identified more closely with what Dave was saying, but weren't there because of these kinds of issues. Now, let me tell you what happened. If you don't mind my giving kind of a personal illustration, I think there's some, perhaps some how-tos in it for all of us, at least some principles that we can draw from. Some of you are aware, because I taught one class relevant to it, that September was just an impossible month for us. We knew it. We knew it was going to be difficult because I did a very dumb thing. I mean, it's just stupid. There's no other way to describe it. It's just a dumb thing. I overcommitted myself totally in September. I don't know how it happened. I didn't intend for it to happen. And you may not believe this, but I don't do that month after month. You don't see me a lot on Sunday because when I speak, it's usually on a Saturday. And I get home sometime 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, depending on where I have to fly from. So I'm sometimes not here on Sunday, but I'm at home. And I reserve time for my family. And during the summer, we had a good time together. And we went to Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia and Williamsburg and all around the East. And that was one trip. We went to Snowmass, Colorado and back on another trip. And, of course, in Easter, we went to Hawaii and back. And we did a lot of things together this summer. And we had a good summer. But we knew September was going to be bad. And we talked about it before. And I said, Shirley, don't expect a whole lot in September. I'm going to be gone. It's a horrible month. I spoke 5 out of 6 weekends in a row, September and into October. And just had a lot of problems, tax audit and a lot of things. It took a tremendous amount of my time. And so it was a real struggle. And at the end of this time, the weekend prior to last weekend, we had a praise gathering in Cincinnati with Bill Gaither. And let me also remind you that during the month of September, Shirley's grandmother died, and her uncle had a stroke, and my uncle died, and my father was sick. And we were back in Kansas City at his bedside about 7 days in September. So, you know, you add that to all the other things. It's just a terrible month. So we had no family life to speak of at all in September. And very little going between us, and Shirley had to handle things with the kids and all the rest of it. But the cruncher of it was that praise gathering in Cincinnati. I spoke there week before last, and folks, you'd have to see a praise gathering to believe it. There were 8,000 people there, jammed into this auditorium. They could have sold another 8,000 seats if they'd had them. In fact, they had about 700 seats that were behind a post, and people were fighting for those. The excitement, the enthusiasm that everybody brought there, primarily for the Gaithers and for Doug Oldham and Dave Boyer and Evie and the Imperials, just a lot of good music and a few speakers dotted along. And it was just a very exciting weekend, but an emotional weekend. And I was absolutely drained when I got out of there. The last day, Saturday, we got up at 5:45 in the morning. That's 3 hours difference in time zone, which is 2:45 my time. And I had a kind of a prayer breakfast with all the people who were working that day. And then I started speaking at 8 o'clock in the morning, which was 5 o'clock in the morning my time. Spoke all day long. After every time when I spoke, I had maybe 100 people lined up to talk to me, each person pulling on me, asking something of me. I was standing praying with people who just lost a child, emotional kinds of experience. People really bared their soul. And I mean to tell you, by about 5 o'clock that night, I was as close to exhaustion as I've ever been in my life. But I had to catch a plane to Kansas City because my folks were not doing very well. And you know, my dad's been in the hospital, and my mother wasn't handling that very well. And I flew through Chicago, which was a mistake. It always is. Had a 3-hour layover there, plane late. And I got into Kansas City at 11:30 at night as just that bone tired, worn completely out. But had to give to my folks, get them put together and pumped up and all day Sunday and Monday. And I got home Monday night. Absolutely nothing left. Things had been accumulating in my office. So I had Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of hard work there. Then came the weekend, last weekend. All right, Shirley and I come into last weekend on a collision course. See, because our trains are coming on the same track right toward each other. You know why? Because we had a different assumption about that weekend. You see, my assumption was, Lord, I am exhausted. I've got to find a place to fall. I got to find a place to repair. And what I needed was to pull into my shell, get away from all conversation and all people. Watch the SC Alabama game. That's what I really needed more than anything else. And my assumption was that weekend is going to be a weekend of regeneration. I'm too tired to give to anybody. Shirley's assumption from the weekend, however,
is quite different from mine. Her assumption is, I've been holding this thing together at home for 6 weeks. I've been taking care of these kids. I've been cooking meals. I've been hauling kids to school, running back and forth. I have not had anything in the order of a date or any romantic life or any adult conversation. At last, Jim is home, and it's over. Now he's coming back, and he'll take over. Well, we made it through Friday night and Saturday morning and did pretty well through breakfast. We had breakfast together out on the patio, out in the back, and the kids finished first, and they were gone. And then Shirley just kind of casually said, Jim, I have a few little things I'd like you to do today. I knew Shirley couldn't stay quiet. For one thing, she said, I want you to wash down the umbrella that's over the patio, because we did have the singles coming for dinner that night. Not for dinner, but they were coming. There were about 75 of those young people coming, and Shirley had the responsibility of getting the house kind of straightened out for them, and so she wanted me to get out there in that hot sun and wash down that umbrella. And you see, that made me angry, because I was so tired and I felt she didn't understand my fatigue. And what she's thinking, you see, is I've got the responsibility of getting ready for all these people. That's not too much to ask. You see the different perspectives. And I said, no way. And I said it with ice all over it, see. What I said was, not only will I not do it, but I resent you asking me. And we had about four or five little short, terse exchanges of communication, followed by 48 hours of silence. You ever been through that? You know. And Shirley went in the house, and boy, I felt I was never been so right in my life. And that started the weekend. That was Saturday morning. And you know how those things go. I went ahead, and I took a bike ride first, and was gone for about an hour, came back, and watched the SC-Alabama game. Tension growing through the day. No communication, no conversation, a lot of sighing. Then it's bedtime, and we both go to bed about 11 o'clock at night, and we have a king-size bed, and it's about 8 feet between us. And nobody's talking, but it's a lot of turning and rolling, you know. And she's over on one side clinging to her brink, and I'm over here clinging to my brink. And then about 20 minutes, she gets up and takes two aspirin and comes back to bed. And about 15 minutes, I go put some nose drops in my nose. And have you been through this? You know. And then we come to church on Sunday morning for a great blessing, you know. And Dave talks on love and marriage. And we're sitting there with hurt. And with deep feeling. Now, you see, even through the midst of that, I had no desire to hurt Shirley, and she had no desire to hurt me. But we both were feeling deeply hurt with each other for not being understood and for having our feelings not comprehended. And it was a rather tense situation. Sunday afternoon, I had my way. I watched the Cowboys and the Cardinals on television Sunday afternoon. The tension grew. Monday night, I watched the Rams. Tuesday night, I watched the World Series. Wednesday night, I watched the second game of the World Series. Thursday morning, Shirley went to the attorney. No, it wasn't quite that bad. As the rest was accomplished, I began to feel better. And began to get it back together and began to be able to give a little more. Wednesday, we had a wonderful day, really a time of real closeness and communication. I came home from work, I felt good, and the family felt good, and we went out in the backyard and we played baseball together, just the four of us, which is really an art if you can pull that off with Ryan handling the outfield. And we really enjoyed each other, played ping pong, and I let Shirley almost beat me, which helped a lot. And really had a very close time together Wednesday night, time of communication. Thursday morning, instead of going into work at the usual time, we went out to breakfast together and just reunited and talked it all out and came to terms with each other. And Shirley just couldn't keep her hands off my pink body. As if stroking my hair and patting my double chin and all the rest of it. You all have been through those kinds of experiences and those kinds of problems. And I think there are several lessons to be learned in them. In fact, maybe I ought to put them on the board. First, and maybe most importantly, all miscommunication, these kind of problems, all result from differing assumptions. You see, Shirley and I had a different assumption for that weekend. To tell you the truth, the whole problem was my fault. It really was, because if I had told Shirley, give me one more week, I am exhausted, I can't make it, I can't talk, I can't give, I can't handle the kids, I can't do anything for one more week, she would have accepted it. But you see, what happened is I didn't tell her, I didn't communicate with her, I didn't straighten out that assumption. And if she had told me, perhaps, I have done all this and I'm right to the breaking point, I really need you. If we had just straightened out our assumptions before we got into it, we could have headed off this problem. You see, but we went into the weekend without communicating and without straightening out our assumptions, and so we really ran into a great miscommunication. See, most marital problems result from differing assumptions. There are many men, perhaps some here, who have the assumption that if they earn a living, a good living for their family, they have done their job. That's a very common assumption. If I feed my family and feed them right and am faithful to my family, that is, I don't get involved with any other women, if I remain loyal and if I feed my family and meet their financial needs, then that constitutes my job. If that's your assumption, your wife may have another assumption that in addition to that, you should clean off the umbrella over the patio or involve me romantically or perhaps contribute to the discipline of the children or other things. See, if your assumptions are not right, you get into miscommunication. Second thing to be learned from that episode, hostility and conflict usually grow out of deep hurt. You see, my conflict with Shirley last weekend, as I said, was not an attempt to debase her or hurt her or be mean to her. I was hurt. I was saying, both of us were saying, meet my needs, bind my wounds, understand my situation, care for me, love me. You're trying to take advantage of me. You're selfish. You only want your own way. See, it grows out of hurt, and that produces bitterness. Did I say this the other day, that bitterness always grows out of self-pity? In fact, G. Gordon Liddy said it. They asked him if he was bitter over Nixon not going to jail and all the rest of them. He said, no, I'm not bitter, because bitterness extracts a price in self-pity. You see, and those of us who are bitter with each other usually are expressing self-pity and this kind of deep hurt. And it's all in the way you looked at it. You can see how both of us had a point of view last weekend. We were both right, and yet we were both dead wrong as well. Number three, and last, overcommitment is the number one marriage killer. You see, that situation last weekend was really my fault, totally, because I allowed myself to get overcommitted. It was dumb. I shouldn't have done it. I didn't mean to do it. It's stupid. And there's no other word for it. To plan to be gone 5 out of 6 weekends a row when you're trying to be a husband and father too. And when you've got other responsibilities when you get back. I allowed that thing to happen. You see, and when you're overcommitted as a husband and you come home, you've got nothing left to give. And so you start thinking about your needs. And then when they're not met, you get angry. And the wife who's been waiting at home, this is the reason I shared that with you today, is because it's so typical. The circumstances are a little different. But that's going on all over this world, certainly in the Western world, where husbands are racing and running and killing themselves and their families and their marriage because of it. Folks, I'm not trying to sound noble to you all today, because I've already admitted to you that I'm far from perfect in this regard. But I have promised Shirley in 1978, not as a result of this weekend, but prior to it. In fact, last summer, I have promised her a normal year in 1978. A normal year. Now, I haven't defined that for her. And I don't know if I'm going to define it. But what does that mean? That means home most evenings without work to do. That means home most weekends. That means coming home with something left for the family. That means giving only part of my life and part of my energy to my ministry and reserving some of it for what I really care about more than anything in the world, which is Shirley and Ryan and Danae. That's got to be number one. I'm an evangelical. I want to evangelize the world. I want to reach as many people as I can for the Lord. I want to strengthen families. But my number one responsibility has to be my family. And if I lose it there, folks, I lose it. There is no substitute for my responsibilities within my own family. That's why I'm resigning the centurion class, January 1, 1978. That's why I have resigned from Children's Hospital in USC. And that was a tough decision to make. But I believe God's in it because I can't do it all. And I have to make some choices and some decisions. That's why I spoke about 25 times in 77. And I receive about 750 speaking requests a year, and I'm taking 14 of them in 78. Just about one a month. And I'm sure Satan will find other ways to sneak in the back door and to get me to say, well, now that I'm not working so hard, sure, I could do that. Hey, that's exciting. Man alive, that would meet my ego needs. That would make money. That's good. Sure, I could probably do that. I might have to do it on Monday night, maybe, but... Okay, I'll take that. Besides, it's 6 months off. I don't have to worry about it now. See, that's what happened in September of this year. I made those decisions a year ago in 1976 when I didn't have to think about it for 12 months. I'm trying now to think about 1978 and not make those mistakes. I really feel that if Satan can get you to overcommit yourself, that's all that is required to destroy a relationship between a husband and wife. I have said this before in this class, and it bears repeating 1,000 times because I really don't think people hear it. Maybe they don't want to hear it. But husbands and wives usually have a different set of emotional needs that have been denied by the women's liberation movement. There are many aspects of the women's liberation movement that I think are healthy and constructive. It's called attention to the needs of women, and some changes are taking place in our society that I think needed to occur, needed to change. But the least acceptable tenet of the women's liberation movement to me is the notion that males and females are identical, except for the ability to bear children. Folks, that's nonsense. It's just not true. Dave said it. I've said it over and over again. Men and women are different, and we are different every way, anatomically, biochemically, one has a menstrual cycle, the other it doesn't. That makes a difference emotionally. We are different hormonally, obviously. We're different physiologically. We're different psychologically, different socially, different sexually. God made them male and female. Not one sex, but two. Unisex is a nonsense. And one of the ways that we are different, part of it being cultural and perhaps part of it genetic, I don't know. Don't know how to sort it out. But men who are out in the working world develop self-esteem very differently than women who are at home with small children. Men who are working outside the home usually develop their self-esteem from their jobs, from feeling good about earning a living, from seeing a business grow, from earning property, from the things that they tell each other. When two men are getting introduced to each other, what do they say? Well, I'm president of this, and I went to that school, and I own that, and we're building a condominium over here, you see. And they share things about their working world, because that builds self-esteem in a man. That's why it's very easy for a man to do what I did in September. I didn't fight that. I enjoyed it. And it's the balance that Shirley and the kids give me, because if I didn't have a family, folks, I could work like that all the time and just kill myself, because I enjoy it. Why? I suppose because it meets my needs. A woman at home raising children, however, develops her self-esteem from a very different source, not primarily from a job, even the job of raising those children, but from her relationship with her husband. He provides a service for her that she does not provide directly for him. She needs him in a way that he does not directly need her. I'm not saying men don't need their wives. I'm not saying that that companionship isn't important. I am saying that a man's self-esteem, his self-worth, is usually rooted outside the home and not inside it. I said what men say to each other when they're getting acquainted with each other. See, they don't say, well, you know, my wife is doing very well, and my children are doing great in school. You see, they start talking about the things that meet their needs. We all do that. Nearly all of us do that. Women, on the other hand, develop their self-esteem from the romantic relationship with the husband. And this is the reason that the anniversary is so much more important to women than it is men. And this is the reason that she's reaching for him when he's at home and trying to get him out of the newspaper or a magazine or Monday Night Football. And why she hates Howard Cosell so much. See, these again are basic principles, I think, of the home and the family. And that if you overcommit yourself, you cannot meet your wife's emotional needs. And it is the quickest way to destroy a marriage. Most marriages that I see that are too far gone to preserve, those that are heading for the divorce courts, did not begin with one person saying, I don't think I like you anymore, and I don't want to live with you anymore, and I'm going to see if I can get rid of you. You know how it starts? It starts with people going down two different tracks. See, one person saying, meet my needs, and the other person saying, I'm tired. See, this combination of last weekend, if you allowed it to go on, and a wife begins to scream, meet my needs, I need you, I want you, and the husband either not understanding or being gone all the time. And when he comes home, he's too tired to accept that responsibility. And then you start going opposite directions. That is the marriage killer. Simple little thing. You know, it's not hard to describe, but it sure is hard to change. And if you're dissatisfied with your marriage, if you heard Dave last weekend and you want to do what he said, the place to begin is reserving something of your resources, time, effort, energy, and money for your relationship instead of giving all that you have to a job. That's all I came to say today. Do you have any comments?
The first question was from Donna, who asked,
this topic has been so relevant to me because my husband and I had to learn some of these same lessons the hard way. But I'd like to know why couples have to go through this struggle. Why can't they be taught about the dangers of overcommitment before they're married, with the purpose of heading off some of their problems? Couldn't we offer premarital classes that would help husbands and wives avoid the trap we fell into?
It would be healthy if we could take young people before they got married and discuss some of these things, but that's almost impossible to do. I've tried it, and people don't want information until they have a problem. You see, and before you're married, this is not a problem. Romantic love is at its peak at that point. And courtesy and opening the door and bringing flowers will probably never again be quite as high as it is at that point. So to sit down and talk to those people about the need to continue these things after marriage, they'll say, yeah, well, I know all that. We're doing that. And they haven't yet experienced the pain of the hurt in item three. And so they're not looking for help and information. Jim, have you found the same thing true?
I've never been more in agreement and never more in need of something like you've been saying. I've never taken more notes than I did today because I've observed this problem every day in my practice. I've experienced it as a psychologist and I've experienced it in my personal life. But as you said, premarital counseling is rarely successful in helping people avoid these kinds of pitfalls. Everybody has to bump his head on the same old rock.
Let me tell you something with all of the emotion that is within me. Everybody I know is making this mistake. I don't know anybody who isn't doing it. All of my friends. You people are doing it. I am doing it. Everybody's doing it. My doctor's doing it. My lawyer's doing it. My agent is doing it. Everybody is doing it. If you're honest, you're doing it. Overcommitting yourself. And it's a form of marital suicide. And as Jim said, it's awfully hard to get people to deal with it. Larry?
How do you balance these needs with the guilt feelings you have sometimes when you know that there are things that have to be done that are worthwhile, especially with regard to the duties of the church?
There are some good responsibilities, some good deeds that need to be done, some things that are God's work that you can't do. You have to be reasonable about it. About a week ago, someone handed me a little advertisement out of a magazine written by Gallo Wines telling how they produce their wines. And I think it has a message within it relevant to at least my situation and maybe some of yours as well. Did you know, and I didn't know, that they not only prune the dead branches off of a vine, but they also prune a certain amount of the fruit off of the vine? In other words, it's not just the non-producing elements that they eliminate. They also eliminate some of the fruit. They could have a larger crop, but they prune back some of the fruit so that what fruit is left will be better. You get the message? As a matter of fact, let me read something to you. From John 15, verse 1 and 2, I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He lops off every branch that doesn't produce, the dead vines and those that aren't producing. But get the next sentence. And he prunes those branches that bear fruit for even larger crops. It is necessary, folks, in the Christian life, to eliminate some good things from your schedule and from your effort, so that the other things that you do are done better, so that you get better quality in what's remaining. That's how I came to resign from teaching this class. I love this class. I love to teach the class. I think it's a good service, at least from my perspective. And yet I had to decide, what can I do and what can't I do? And how do you control a schedule like this? How do you decide? I think that it's done the same way you control any other aspect of your life that requires discipline. It takes guts. It's an earthy word, but there's no other word for it. The same way you control your appetite. How do you keep from gaining weight? You do it by saying, I won't eat that, but I want it. It looks good to me. It's available. I won't eat it. And it's the same thing, I think, with regard to our schedules. But I want to teach the centurion class, but I have to decide what I can do. And you lop off some fruit so that what remains has a better quality. The reason I feel this so strongly is because it just bounces off you and hits me between the eyes. In 1970, folks, I thought that everything this church asked me to do was directly from the Lord. I really believed that. And I took everything that came to me. And I was superintendent of youth. And, man, I was down here for meetings, and I was on a church board, and I was doing all kinds of stuff, teaching Sunday school class on Sunday morning. And I went 17 nights without being home one time. And I began to realize that the Lord wanted me to use discretion even in this area of service. And that's what I'm trying to do, and I'm still working at it. Bill?
I'm not trying to give an excuse, but it does seem that I'm working harder than ever before, yet I seem to be making less money. Inflation, rising taxes, increasing costs for goods and services, and insurance are just putting on the pressure. It seems as if I have to work more just to make ends meet at home, and that takes more time.
I'm convinced of that materialism plays a role in all of it. But when I come to the end of my life, Bill, and I look back over it, and I'm deciding what was and was not worthwhile in my life, the purchase of a new couch to replace a ragged one is not going to carry the same weight as the weekend that Shirley and I went to Newport Beach and spent walking up and down the beach together talking. You know, I realize that we're all under inflationary pressures, and it does take a lot of money to stay alive. And I understand that, and I'm not downgrading it. But I also feel that every man alive can look you right in the eye and tell you why he has to work as hard as he's working, that he really doesn't have any choice. Every man can tell you that. They need me. I have to work. I have the business. I have the responsibility. I have the patients. I have the clients. I've got to do this. I've got to get a practice going. See, everybody can tell you why. My goodness, a hospital, got to work there. They're requiring my responsibility. I'm speaking. I can't turn down all that speaking. I'm counseling. The phone rings. I got to answer the mail. All of us can say that. But the truth of the matter is, most of us, as men, work that hard because we choose to work that hard. We choose to because we get our ego needs met through our work. And again, I'm not browbeating you. I'm talking about myself. And it's the aspect of myself that disgusts me most and that I most want to bring under the control of the Lord so that my time is scheduled not by my ego, but by my God. Yeah, Tom?
Several months ago, I was going through great pressure and I had a struggle over what my priority should be. And I began having some pains and physical problems, which caused me to see Dr. Victor Herlocker. After examining me, he said, "Tom, I'm going to tell you what's wrong with you, and then I'll give you a very easy prescription. You're going to have to decide whether you're working to live or living to work." That said a lot of things to me because I'm a policeman, and my supervisor and my peers expect a lot from me in the way of working late and carrying heavy responsibilities. But after thinking it over, I decided to walk out of the office at the end of each day and leave it all behind. And I've felt better ever since.
You're right on it, Tom. As a matter of fact, the PALCON conference was just held down in San Diego at Point Loma College. And Pastor Lee came back and told you how meaningful that was, and I understand that it was really a powerful session. And I was not there, so I cannot say if this was really said. But someone told me that it was, and it wouldn't surprise me if it was. Someone said that if they're really doing their jobs at the church, they are working 70 hours a week. Now, it doesn't take a mathematician to figure that out. 70 hours a week is 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. And friends and neighbors, that leaves nothing for the little children in their homes or for the wives that are involved. And I say, nonsense. I'd like to know the man who said that, and I'd like to point out a few things to him. You work 70 hours a week, folks, don't expect to have a family, except in name only. Lois.
I'm convinced that Satan is going to have a field day over our conversation this morning, because he wants us to overcommit ourselves, especially on Saturday night or Sunday morning. 1 Peter 5:7 and 8 says, "Let him have all your worries and cares, for he is always thinking about you and watching everything that concerns you. Be careful. Watch out for attacks from Satan, your great enemy. He prowls around like a hungry, roaring lion, looking for some victim to tear apart."
That's beautiful, Lois. And what you said, I'd like to perhaps end with, in terms of Satan having a heyday in this room. Folks, let me tell you something very honestly. When I speak on this subject to audiences that don't know me very well as you know me, you can cut the tension with a knife. I can speak on discipline and everybody laughs and enjoys it. And I can talk about self-esteem and everybody said, "Oh boy, we believe in that." And we go along for about 4 or 5 hours and then I talk about this. And there is a pall that hangs over the crowd and tension develops right between husbands and wives because this is where we live more than any other characteristic of the American family. This is the tension point. This is the pressure point. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of you weren't very uncomfortable with each other at this moment. And I'm not throwing any stones because I don't know who you are. But you know who you are. And if you're doing what I'm saying today, then you're probably a little uncomfortable. But may I remind you that change occurs from confrontation. There is no change as long as I say things that you merely agree with. You only change when something goes counter to you. That's what education is. See, education occurs when the rough edges are hit and knocked off. And what I'm saying today runs counter to the lifestyle of most of you, I would guess. And that is painful. And that produces tension between husband and wife. But if you identified with Dave last week, and you know this is what God wants, then I ask you to reevaluate in the times that you have with your wives and husbands and sit down and talk about where you're going and where you've been and what God really wants of you and see if he has something to say to you. Not to satisfy some standard I set up, but to conform to what God had in the first place. Will you bow your head? Excuse me, Lauren, last comment.
I just want to make a final comment, if I may. Earlene and I have gone through exactly what you and Shirley have experienced, Jim. We've had weekends just like the one you described. But with us, we've noticed that our problems have occurred when we both hit a low at the same time, when we were both down. When that happens, we often find that it produces a confrontation or a crisis in our relationship. So we try to be aware of when we both crash and try to be careful with each other in those times.
Beautifully said. I appreciate your comment. I was getting ready to pray. I really feel that the Lord would have me ask you a question. I hope that the Lord is in this because my purpose is not to put pressure on anybody. Not because I said it or because you must. Is there any man here who will raise your hand and promise your wife with me a normal year in 78? Bless you guys. Pray with me. Heavenly Father, I thank you for being here this morning. I know of all the things that I've talked about in 7 years, there is nothing that you care more about than this topic. Because Satan is using it to take your people and destroy them, and to take your little children and tear them apart. Lord, the family was your idea, and this is a major barrier to it, the tool with which Satan is undermining it. So I just ask you to deal with each person, speak in the terms they need to hear. I do not have the answers to how. Lord, if I had that answer, I would surely have given it today. I don't have that answer. But you do. You have all answers. And if you're in this, and if this is your purpose, you can show each person in his particular situation how to go about rearranging his life to leave time for devotions, time for fellowship, time for teaching, time for value orientation for the children, time for romantic love, time for worship, and time for rest. Lord, we do love you, and we know that you're here in this room today. I thank you for the centurion class. Lord, it'll tear my heart out to see marriages disintegrate here. It is occurring, Lord. Heal the wounds and bind marriages back together again, I pray. Amen. With that anguished prayer, we concluded the centurion class on that particular Sunday morning. But before we end this tape, I just feel I have to share one other very personal matter with you, which is very relevant to the theme of this lesson. And I think it'll also explain why I felt this issue so strongly at the time that I presented it to my class, but why I feel it even more strongly today. Do you remember on the tape early in the discussion, I talked about going through Kansas City to see my parents on the way home from the praise gathering in Cincinnati? Well, what I didn't tell you or what I didn't tell the class was the nature of my dad's illness and why I had gone to see him on such a busy weekend. The first episode in his illness occurred in September of 1977 when Shirley and I had gone to San Antonio, Texas, where I was to speak on Friday to the Texas Pediatric Society's annual conference. We arrived Thursday night at 11:30 and got to the hotel, and awaiting us there was a message from Dr. Paul Cunningham, who is the pastor of the church where my parents are members. Dr. Cunningham had obviously gone to some effort to track me down in San Antonio, and I knew the moment I saw it that something awful had happened. And on the message were the words, "Emergency, please call as soon as possible." I turned to Shirley and I showed her the note, and we both felt that dread and apprehension. Immediately went to the phone and called Dr. Cunningham.
As I suspected, he told me that my dad had had a major myocardial infarction, a heart attack, that the paramedics had arrived in 8 or 10 minutes and had managed to save his life, and they had gotten him to the hospital where he was at that moment. Now, this news was devastating to me because of the kind of relationship that I have with my dad. Not very many people know that my dad is not only my father and my friend, but he's also my partner. Most of the things I write about, most of the things I believe, most of the things that I convey to families and to others in my writing and speaking ministries originated with my dad. He's an avid reader, and he consumes books. He does most of my research, and I depend on him so heavily. And whenever we get together, he does the talking, and I do the note-taking. And he has been like a beacon to me all my life, conveying the messages to me that I have turned around and conveyed to others. He's the quiet partner, and I'm the noisy one. And we have this kind of relationship, just a deep friendship. And it was devastating to me to hear that he was perhaps at the point of death. I asked Dr. Cunningham if he thought that I ought to cancel the activities of the next day, which incidentally were probably the busiest day of the year. And he said, no, your dad is stable in an unstable condition, and I'll stay in touch with you and let you know whether you should come. I went through the activities of the next day, which included a press conference with three reporters, one right after the other, at 9:30 in the morning. At 10:30, I did a radio program with live calls, and there's pressure associated with that. At noon, at 12 o'clock, I did the noon television news. And I came hurrying back to the hotel with only 30 minutes to eat. A meal had been sent up, and then I was to speak to 300 doctors attending the Texas Pediatric Society, the annual conference of that organization there in San Antonio. I opened the door of the hotel, and my wife Shirley met me, and she had tears in her eyes. In fact, her eyes were swollen. I said, "What's the matter, Shirley?" And she said, "Dr. Cunningham wants you to call him back." I immediately went to the phone and called Dr. Cunningham, and he told me that my dad's condition was worsening. In fact, he hated to tell me this, but if I wanted to see my dad alive, that I'd better get there just as quickly as possible, that he was not expected to live through the night. And then Dr. Cunningham gave me another bit of news. He told me that my uncle, with whom I'm very close, had died in the same hospital at 10:30 that morning. I was as devastated as I've ever been in my life, emotionally and physically. And yet I could not give vent to it and let it all go because I had to speak at 2 o'clock to these doctors, and I felt God wanted me to do that. He gave me the wherewithal to pull my wits about me, and I did speak to them and then caught a plane at 4 o'clock, the first plane out, for Kansas City. My wife and I flew to Kansas City, and we wept all the way there on the plane, and so many things went through my mind at that time. But I knew when I got off the plane that if my wife and I were met by my mother, that would mean that my dad was gone, because my mother would not leave him at the hospital in order to come to the airport. And when we got off the plane, my mother was not there. Instead, we were met by the wife of the president of the college where my dad teaches. And she had a smile on her face. And you see, more than 1,000 people had been praying for my dad around the country. He'd been a minister for 45 years, and he'd created a lot of friends in that time, and they were praying for him. And she had a smile on her face, and she said that my dad was better, remarkably better. There'd been a real turnaround. And I'll always be grateful for that and be thankful for it, that the Lord heard those prayers. But, you know, as I was on that plane, so many things were going through my mind. And I became a little boy again. That often happens, I'm told, when a person is facing the loss of a parent that they've been very close to, as I have with my dad. And I thought back on that plane of the very happiest days of my life, the happiest moments of my entire life. And I remembered some events that took place when I was between 10 and 13 years of age as a small boy, where we would get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning before the sun came up on a cold, wintry morning, put on our hunting boots and hunting clothes and hunting jacket, and go out in the car, no one else would be awake, lock the door and leave, drive out into the country, just my dad and me, and find a dirt road and drive way back into the area that I used to call the Big Woods because the trees looked so huge to me, and get out of the car and climb over a fence and go down and follow a little creek back into those woods, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 miles, way back into the woods. It's still dark. The sun hadn't come up. And then my dad would find a little place for me where a tree had fallen and its limbs kind of made a little room to hide me. And he would get me situated under that little room. And he'd go around the bend someplace and get himself hidden there. And we would wait for the sun to come up there. And you see, the birds didn't know that we were there, and the squirrels didn't know that we were there. And we'd watch the whole panorama of nature unfold out there in God's world. And there was something that took place between my dad and me out there in those woods that didn't take place anyplace else, that had such a tremendous impact on my life. Times of closeness and oneness and love between my dad and me. And it made me want to be like that man. And it made me want to take his values as my values and his life as my life. And it's why I followed him and why I never had that tremendous emotional upheaval and conflict that often occurs in adolescence, because there was something that occurred between generations in those happy days of my life. And as I was riding along the plane and thinking about that, I was overwhelmed with emotion. And my wife put her arm around me and she said, "What are you thinking now?" And I said, "I'm thinking about those moments when I come to the end of my life and my two children stand at my bedside and contemplate the happiest days of their lives. What will they remember? What will they think back to? Will it be those kinds of warm, loving days, those human experiences of love between a father and a child? Or will they think of a father who was always running off to Cincinnati to a praise gathering, or was always answering the telephone, or was always answering mail or counseling somebody or meeting this obligation or handling that responsibility or being a big man? Or will they remember a father who had time to show his affection and his love? Life is passing so quickly, and it'll soon be gone. As it turned out, folks, that weekend that I returned from Cincinnati and stopped in Kansas City was the last time I ever saw my beloved father alive. That was October 3rd, 1977. He died suddenly on December 4th of that year. And that hurried weekend represented my last moments with a man that I loved so dearly. Oh, if I could just have that week over again, if I could just live it over, if I could just sit down and talk to my dad, there was so much that I left unsaid. What I would give, I'd give all I own to spend that weekend with him again, but it's gone. And life is passing like that. And what do we really care about? What do you care about? What is really important to you? What is really worthy of your time? And maybe the more important question of this entire tape is, what is really worthy of your overcommitment? What are you spending your life on that outweighs loving relationships between a husband and wife, between a parent and child, between those family members that care for one another? And when you look back on life at the other end of it, will you remember how much money you made? Or whether you made that deadline and that obligation, whether you got that contract, whether you achieved that mark, or will you remember those relationships with those you love? That is the message of this tape. And I thank you for being with me while I shared it with you.